Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is very specific and I think really vital. We've been analyzing a pretty profound set of sources, a recent church service from Harmony, which had this panel discussion, and then a sermon by Kent.
Right.
And we're not really here to analyze the theology itself, but to, you know, pull out the tools that were presented for navigating just profound personal difficulties.
Things like catastrophic loss, severe illness, deep trauma.
Exactly. And what makes this whole thing so relevant is the premise that Kent laid out right at the top.
Yeah, he said that every single person listening is right now either going through something.
Has just gone through something.
Or is about to go through something, which, you know, that really puts this on the most universal ground possible.
It really does. And the central question he put to the panelists was so blunt, it just cut through everything.
Why in the world would you still love Jesus after experiencing such deeply painful things?
It's such a challenging question.
It is. It demands a real answer, not just, you know, a textbook one. And the response from the panel was immediate. It was unified.
Their answer wasn't some complex explanation. It was just hope.
Hope. And this radical belief in divine timing, that it's always perfect, even when it feels agonizingly slow.
Or just makes no sense from our perspective.
Right.
Okay, so let's dig into the reality of that suffering, because the panelists, Connie and Joel Schiffler, Jerry Owens, Harrison and Sharon Baker, I mean, they covered such a spectrum of pain.
They really did. And we should probably slow down on their stories.
Yeah.
Take Connie and Joel. They talked about the loss of their son, Josh, at 39.
And he'd been sick his entire life.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't a sudden thing. It was a long, drawn-out struggle that then ended in tragedy.
Yeah.
And he left four kids behind.
I mean, can you imagine? Decades of worry and then that final loss. How do you find hope in that kind of darkness?
Well, they didn't really describe it as a philosophy. Joel said it was the only thing that literally, physically pulled them through.
So it wasn't something they searched for and found. It was just the only option left.
That's what it sounds like.
Which leads right into Jerry Owens' story. He watched his wife suffer before she passed away.
And he was so honest about his first reaction being just despair. He was asking, "Where are you, Lord?"
Yeah, he wasn't pretending to be pious or immediately accepting.
And what's fascinating is that the process of asking that angry, frustrated question is what actually brought him closer to his faith. It was a confrontation.
And Harrison's story was a different kind of crisis, right? The cancer survivor.
Right. His doctor told him to seek experimental treatment. I mean,
yeah,
that's a moment that forces you to re-examine everything.
It's the ultimate time limiter.
And then there was Sharon Baker, her testimony. It just struck a different kind of chord. Deep childhood abuse, neglect.
Which led to this really turbulent life. Fighting, drinking, a bad temper. She talked about feeling completely worthless.
She was so open about how destructive she used to be.
And this is where we see the most radical transformation. Harrison's crisis focused his attention, but Sharon's. Hers was a total internal collapse that was rebuilt by something external.
She had this amazing quote about it.
Oh, yeah.
She said that when people told her how much she changed, it was a compliment because, and she said, "That's not me. That's not Sharon. That's Jesus Christ."
And that's crucial, especially for anyone thinking about this for their connect groups. It wasn't her finding some inner strength. It was about her accepting this external, undeserved love.
To fill a hole that trauma had left. Yeah, that's a huge point. So these people didn't just survive. They found something in the middle of it all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the hardest part for anyone is seeing where God was when you were in it.
When he felt completely silent.
Exactly.
And that's where this idea of God in the rearview mirror comes in. It takes a long view. You have to commit to looking back.
And Joel Schiffler's story is the perfect example. The immediate tragedy of his son's death. It ended up widening their circle, affecting other people.
But the real payoff, the fulfillment of prayer, that didn't come right away.
No. It came years later. His grandson, who was only 7 when Josh died, gave his life to Christ. You have to look back over a decade of pain to see that one moment of fulfillment.
And we have to remember Joel's own life. I mean, diabetes since age 2, a kidney transplant, open heart surgery, cancer.
It's unbelievable.
He didn't just have one crisis. His whole life was defined by them. Yet he said it resulted in such peace that it was sometimes all he had.
So the peace wasn't the absence of trouble.
Not at all. It was the presence of something solid inside the trouble.
And Jerry gave us a framework for that.
Yeah.
He used the analogy of Peter walking on water.
Yeah, he admitted that he was constantly taking his eyes off his faith and he'd start to sink.
But he said God's hand was always there the second he called out.
He had to hit that low point before he saw the help.
And Sharon. Her revelation was the thing that reframed her entire past. She wrestled with that why me question for so long.
And the answer that brought her peace was realizing that her pain was going to help other people.
Because she would understand what they were feeling.
Exactly. It moves her from being a victim to being uniquely qualified to help. It's a powerful shift.
It really is. Okay, so Pastor Kent takes all these testimonies and then he pivots. He uses this really surprising story from the Bible.
Yeah, from 1 Samuel 21, King David. He moves from modern pain to this ancient example of humiliation and finding refuge.
It's a brilliant move because it makes the need for refuge universal. David, the future king, is at his absolute lowest point.
He's destitute, hunted by King Saul, totally alone. He's lost everything, even his weapons.
This ultimate warrior, Kent calls him the John Wick of his time.
Right.
And he runs straight into the arms of the enemy, the Philistines.
It's a terrifying, desperate act. And of course, they recognize him immediately. This is the guy who killed Goliath.
And thousands of their soldiers. So when he's brought before their king, he knows he's about to be executed. So his act of survival is what?
He pretends to be a madman.
It's just, it's so bizarre. He's drooling, scribbling on the wall, acting completely insane until the king is just disgusted and drives him away.
He finds refuge not in his strength, but in being seen as utterly broken and, frankly, repulsive.
And here's the core revelation of the sermon. It was after this incredibly humiliating escape.
When he pretended to be insane before Abimelech.
That David wrote Psalm 34. The psalm is a direct reflection on this moment.
And this is where it gets really interesting, because if you had survived by pretending to drool on yourself, you'd tell the story of your brilliant acting skills.
Well, for sure. But David doesn't. In Psalm 34, he writes, I sought the Lord and he answered. He delivered me from all my fears.
He gives all the credit to God, not his own cleverness. He says, the Lord heard him. He saved him out of all of his troubles.
And then the call to action, which ties right back to what the panelists were saying about hope.
Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him.
I have to pause on that, though. Because when you're David, running for your life, drooling on a wall, that's just pure primal self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And Ken makes this powerful distinction between having God as a side novelty and truly fearing him in that sense of reverence. He says God won't play second fiddle. How do you square that crude survival moment with writing a psalm claiming total deliverance?
That is the exact tension Kent was highlighting. He even joked about it, saying that he would have been telling that story at every Connect group for years about his own genius for coming up with the drooling trick.
Right.
But David's reaction was completely different. He saw that the humiliating act was the vehicle God used. He didn't engineer the refuge. He just recognized it was provided for him.
So reverence is a prerequisite for safety. If God is just a novelty, you miss the full deliverance.
Exactly. David was forced to make God his one and only source of refuge. And that leads to the final, really radical insight from the panelists.
When Kent asked them what they'd tell their younger, suffering selves,
yeah.
Joel's son's answer after a lifetime of sickness was just. It was completely counterintuitive. He said, if I hadn't been going through this, I wouldn't have Jesus in my heart right now.
He wouldn't change it. He saw the suffering as the path.
And Sharon's advice to her traumatized younger self was just pure grace.
You are lovable. You are cared about. Just hang on there. It's that external, undeserved love she was talking about.
And that brings up a really critical distinction Kent made about where we look for healing. He contrasted Christ-based healing, which offers that external love to fill the void, with other approaches that can sometimes lead you to just keep digging deeper into yourself, into the wound. And you're left with a void you can't fill on your own.
Right. And I think the ultimate lesson from all this, from the panel and from David's story, is that God isn't the God who gets you out of things.
He's the God who gets you through them.
Yeah. They all had to walk through their crises. The lesson is in that patient presence, not a sudden extraction.
So what does this all mean for you as you get ready for your Connect group discussion?
I think the core insight, like Kent summarized, is that true thankfulness starts with what he called the art of recognition.
It's an intentional choice.
It is. It's looking back at your own story, even the damaged, humiliated parts, and recognizing where divine influence was working all along, even when you felt completely alone.
Or felt like you had to drool on a wall to survive.
Exactly.
So maybe here's a final thought to take into your discussions. If you were to sit down today and rewrite the damaged parts of your personal story, where would you intentionally place the hand of God? Where do you change the narrative from, this was the moment I gave up, to that powerful conclusion, this was the moment he got me through, that act of recognition, I think, changes everything.